This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Baghdad today, a suicide bomb exploded at an American military checkpoint. Four Marines are reported injured, though details of this incident are still coming in. Though jubilant celebrations continued in some parts of Baghdad, there was also widespread looting, and in other parts of the city, U.S. forces fought Saddam loyalists, paramilitaries, and Arab volunteers. In one battle in East Baghdad, one Marine was killed and 20 others wounded. While U.S. forces attempt to secure Iraq's capital, Central Command spokesman Major General Gene Renouard acknowledged today that there is still a long way to go. Quote, "We're not sure when a military victory will be complete." Coming up, we'll hear the messages that President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair broadcast to the Iraqi people today and talk about the propaganda campaign. Also, a power user's guide to the flags of Iraq. But first, we want to check in on the change in northern Iraq, where Kurdish capture of the city of Kirkuk set off alarm bells in Ankara and Washington. Joining us now from Kirkuk is Jonathan Landay, a reporter for the Knight Ridder News Service. Good of you to be with us again.
My pleasure.
Tell us what happened today in Kirkuk as the Kurds arrived.
Well, essentially what happened was the Iraqi forces, having been pummeled for weeks from the air by the United States and facing advancing Kurdish forces as well as the U.S. special forces, basically threw their weapons away, took their uniforms off, and fled. And having realized that this had happened, the residents of this city came pouring into the streets in riotous, joyous celebration, as well as widespread looting and the ransacking government offices and offices of the Ba'ath Party.
We had been told many times before this war began that once the Kurds took control of the city, there were great fears of retribution against Sunni Arabs who had been relocated to that city by Saddam Hussein.
Well, I'm told by many city residents that beginning last week, the Arab settlers, as they're known, saw the writing on the wall and began leaving the city, and basically there are none left. Indeed, a couple of days before today, when I got very close to the outskirts of the city, I noticed that many wheat fields that had been planted by Arab settlers were still standing, but the Arabs themselves had gone. And so we don't see any of this retribution at all. There is a lot of gunfire. At least two people have been killed and more than 14 wounded by bullets fired into the air in celebration of what's happening. And as I said, there's been a lot of widespread looting, but we haven't seen the kind of ethnic retribution that had been feared here in Kirkuk.
Now, you mentioned U.S. Special Forces are part of this operation. The White House and Secretary of State Powell today apparently reassured Ankara, the Turkish government, that Kirkuk would be under the control of U.S. forces.
Yes, indeed. I was told by a very senior Kurdish general, as well as a member of a special forces team and a very senior Kurdish official, that the Kurdish fighters, who are known as Peshmerga, are going to be withdrawn from the city and replaced by American troops. And they're probably going to be troops, paratroopers who were deployed several weeks ago in the Kurd held enclave of northern Iraq in a place called Harir. So the word is now that those paratroopers will be coming here and taking over security, and the Kurdish fighters themselves withdrawn back to where they came from.
Now, can you tell us also, Kirkuk was sometimes described as the Jerusalem of the Kurds. Why is this city so important?
Well, it's become a symbol of the suffering that the Kurds have endured under Saddam Hussein. Tens of thousands were killed by the regime. Tens of thousands were ethnically cleansed from their properties here in Kirkuk and in other oil-rich parts of northern Iraq, And their properties given to Arabs resettled from other parts of Iraq. This so-called Arabization program aimed at consolidating the regime's control of areas with a lot of oil in them. There are tens of thousands of displaced Kurds and other ethnic minorities, Turkmen, Assyrians, who are living in the Kurd-held enclave not too far from here in pretty squalid conditions and who want to return to their homes here. Now, the United States and the Kurdish parties have agreed to create a mechanism to ensure the orderly return of these displaced people, but of course that hasn't even begun to happen yet, as we're only hours into the liberation of this city.
Now, there were also, as you mentioned, this is an oil-rich area, reports of an oil fire there. What do you know about that?
There's only one oil well that appears to be on fire, and in fact it appears that the oil fields to the southeast and northwest of the city appear in pretty good shape. They seem to be intact except for this one oil fire. And this field is one of the largest in Iraq, indeed one of the largest in the Middle East. It's believed that it is actually contains many more reserves than are actually proven at this point. So it is quite an achievement for the coalition to get these oil fields in pretty good shape.
In the Rumaila oil fields in southern Iraq, people found that they had been wired for destruction, though most of them were not triggered for one reason or another. Any indication of sabotage in the oil fields around Kirkuk?
Actually, I have to say that I don't know. I have not been out there. It's just been a pretty wild ride here in the city trying to cover what's been going on. I started very, very early this morning with the Peshmerga on the outskirts of the city. There was fighting this morning. There were pretty heavy B-52 strikes on the front lines, and those seem to be the final straw in what precipitated the Iraqi withdrawal from the Iraqi army withdrawal from Kirkuk.
And it is quite late at night there. Now, what does the city look like?
Well, the celebration seemed to have cooled off quite a bit. I don't hear the honking of the horns anymore that we were hearing earlier. There is still sporadic gunfire and the occasional cheering and honking from cars, but nowhere near the decibel level that it was earlier. It seems like things are cooling down.
Jonathan Landay, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Landay is a reporter for Knight Ridder and spoke to us from Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Let us go now to Philip Pan, a correspondent for The Washington Post who is based in Ankara, Turkey, and good of you to speak with us.
My pleasure.
How are Turks reacting to the not only the scenes of celebrating Kurds in northern Iraq, but specifically to their capture of the city of Kirkuk?
Well, I think people in Turkey are upset and nervous about what's going to happen next in Kirkuk. They have always said that they oppose Kurdish control of that city, and they feel somewhat betrayed by the United States, which has promised that the Kurds would not take over that city. They're waiting now to see if the United States is going to keep that promise to withdraw the Kurds. If it doesn't, I think Turkey would consider invading and trying to expel them forcefully.
Now, earlier today, I understand there was a telephone conversation between Abdullah Gül, the foreign minister of Turkey, and Secretary of State Colin Powell.
That's right. There was a phone conversation. I think there was an agreement that Turkey would wait and see what would happen. The United States has agreed to allow Turkey to send some military observers to Kirkuk to watch the withdrawal of the Kurds. I think people in Turkey are just a little bit concerned about whether that's going to happen. Obviously, this was a hard-won victory for the Kurdish fighters, and they're wondering whether the Kurds are really going to be willing to give it up.
And whether they might not take Kirkuk, as many Turks have feared for a long time, as the capital of what they might hope to be eventually an independent Kurdish state.
That's right. That's the main concern of the Turks. They don't want to see an independent Kurdish state. They believe that would fuel a violent separatist movement among their own Kurdish population within Turkey. At the same time, there's also a sense among many Turks that Kirkuk is historically a Turkish city and not a Kurdish city, that there originally were many more ethnic Turkmen residents of Kirkuk than Kurds, and they are worried that now that the Kurds are in the city of Kirkuk, that they are going to try to expel the Turkmen residents, loot their homes. There's been a lot of reporting on television tonight from the Turkish television stations that the Kurdish fighters have already burned or removed the land records from the courthouses that would prove Turkish ownership of some of the property there.
Mm-hmm. Now, Turkey could have had a much bigger say in what's going on in northern Iraq had it agreed to allow U.S. forces to use Turkish soil to launch part of the invasion of Iraq. They decided not to. Is there any second-guessing in Ankara?
Well, I think there's been a lot of second-guessing all along, ever since they've decided not to. Certainly the Americans have been telling the Turks that if you had let us in there, we would have been able to take the city ourselves without using the Kurds at all. And so there is second-guessing, but I think they're at the stage right now where they're not really inclined to sort of look at their own errors. They're just worried about what's going to happen next and whether they're going to need to order a military reaction to this.
And what would happen, do Turks think, if even in response to Kurdish provocations, which have yet to occur, but even if there are Kurdish provocations, if they send forces across, what do the Turks think the United States would do?
Well, this is where it gets very tricky for the Turks. They say that they're not going to do anything without coordinating with the United States, but it seems unlikely that the United States would allow the Turks to invade. When you ask them about that, the Turks say they will always reserve the right to sort of defend their national security interests, and they see this as a direct national security interest. So the bottom line for them is that they're willing to defy the United States, defy the European Union, and defy NATO to do this if they feel it's necessary. It would come at a tremendous cost for Turkey. The economy here is not doing well, and it's basically on life support thanks to the United States. They would lose a lot of U.S. support for the economic aid that it receives right now. Turkey's been a longtime member of NATO, and Germany has already threatened to withdraw some of its support for Turkey as a NATO member. And Turkey has always wanted to join the European Union, and ministers at the European Union have said that if Turkey goes into northern Iraq, that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the reason the Turkish parliament voted against use of Turkish soil to launch part of the invasion was because 94-95% of the population there was opposed to this. What has the response been there to the fall of Baghdad?
Response has been fairly muted. They're happy to see the war moving along quickly. I think people here still are primarily concerned about the civilian casualties that have been the result of the war. They are still worried about the future of Iraq, particularly obviously northern Iraq. They're worried that this is going to devolve into some sort of chaotic situation, that it's going to actually create more terrorism, not less, and that it's going to be very hard for the United States to establish a democratic state there. They feel that they know these people, they've lived next to them, and that democracy there is going to be very tough.
Yes, and democracy in Turkey has been very tough, but what did they make of the joyous faces of the people who were toppling the statues of Saddam yesterday?
Well, I think they have mixed feelings about it. They're happy to see people happy, but they at the same time they're watching the media reports about the civilian casualties. They are worried that this sort of joy right now is momentary, and that it may not last. That as the difficult work of establishing a democracy in Iraq begins, that things are going to get messy again. And they're particularly worried, as is natural, about their own situation, which is what's going to happen in northern Iraq. They are very worried that there's going to be an independent Kurdish state established.
Philip, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Philip Pan is with The Washington Post and spoke with us from Ankara, the capital of Turkey. Coming up after the break, we will look a bit further south to the city of Tikrit, the hometown and power base of Saddam Hussein, an area without American military presence, at least at the moment. And later in the program, we'll hear in the messages broadcast by President Bush and Prime Minister Blair to the Iraqi people today. What do you think the message that the United States and Britain should broadcast to the Iraqi people ought to be? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the news out of Iraq today. And later in the program, we'll be listening to the messages broadcast by President Blair and Prime Minister Blair and President Bush. They sent messages on television to the Iraqi people today. And if you have an idea of what the messages the U.S. should be broadcasting to the Iraqi people might be, give us a phone call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address again, TOTN at NPR.org. For the next few minutes, though, we will focus on Saddam Hussein's hometown and power base, the city of Tikrit, located about an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours' drive north of Baghdad. Joining us now from his home in London is Con Coughlin, author of the book Saddam, King of Terror. And Con Coughlin, good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Tikrit is often described as Saddam Hussein's power base. Why is that?
Well, that's where Saddam comes from, actually. He was born in a little village just outside Tikrit, and his father died or disappeared when he was quite young, and he moved to Tikrit when he was a young boy to be brought up by his uncle. And he then sort of moved backwards and forwards between his uncle and his mother. But basically, Tikrit is regarded by Saddam as his hometown. His official name has been, until recently, his official name is Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti, from Tikrit. So this is where Saddam identifies himself, and over the years he's invested a lot of money in Tikrit, basically buying the loyalty of the Tikritis. Although it must be said that Saddam's own family, the Al-Majids, are actually a very sort of humble family. They're not one of the noble families of Tikrit. And actually, Tikritis, the old Tikriti families, regard Saddam as something of an upstart. But of course, people who've voiced those opinions when Saddam was in power have found themselves mysteriously disappearing.
He has, no one knows where he is now, of course, but he has used Tikrit before as a place of refuge.
He has, yeah. Most famously, I mean, we're going back a bit in history, but the whole incident in 1959, when he undertook his first assassination attempt of the then Iraqi president, the whole thing failed. And Saddam fled from Baghdad to Tikrit, and as I sort of detail in my book, Saddam has turned this into something of a legend, saying how he had to swim across the Tigris and came across police patrols that he had to dodge, and he turned the whole thing into quite a melodrama. So you know, now that Saddam again is in the crosshairs of the coalition forces, it's reasonable to expect, assuming he's still alive, that he would head for Tikrit again.
Mm-hmm. Now, one way to look at the progress that U.S. and British forces and Kurdish forces now in the north have made is that they have largely liberated the parts of Iraq dominated by Shias and Kurds, the part of the country dominated by Sunnis, Baghdad and north of there, Tikrit. That's the area where U.S. forces have not gone yet.
Yes, no, and it's fascinating that the liberation campaign has been conducted in this way. It's clearly quite deliberate, and I think, as we all know, from the outset of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the idea was to liberate Iraq from the Ba'athist control, and the majority of the hardcore of the Ba'ath Party are Sunnis, and the elite, the elite people in Saddam's Ba'athist regime are Tikritis. They're his family members, people like the recently killed Kemal Ali, and Saddam's half brothers, of course. Barzan, in particular, the bad man of the regime, is a Tikriti. And so the Tikritis are actually quite central to Saddam's regime. And I suppose, I mean, although we've seen these joyous scenes in Baghdad, or certainly they were joyous yesterday, they're not quite so joyous today, mm-hmm. As the Ba'athists have put up some stiff resistance. But I think we've still got a long road to travel before the whole of Iraq is under coalition control.
One other question about Tikrit. It is also, according to legend at least, the hometown of the 12th century great Muslim warrior Saladin, a man who defeated Richard Lionheart and all of that sort of stuff, a Kurdish man from his ethnic origin, but it must have a tremendous symbolic importance to Iraqis.
It is, which is of course, one of the reasons why Saddam has turned himself into a Tikriti. As I said, he calls himself Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti. And Saddam's propaganda machine, which has been just as important as the security apparatus in keeping him in power these past 30-odd years, the propaganda machine has made a great deal of the fact that Saddam hails from the same city of Saladin. And, of course, it was Saladin who liberated Jerusalem from the Crusaders in the 12th century. And in his anti-Zionist propaganda, Saddam has made much of the parallels between his own desire to liberate Jerusalem from the what he sees as the new occupiers, the Zionists, the Israelis, with Saladin, who liberated the Christian occupiers so many years ago.
And indeed, some of the statues and paintings of Saddam Hussein that we've seen are so common across Iraq have him wearing headdresses and robes associated with Saladin.
Precisely. Well, I think as many of your listeners will know, Neil, you can hardly move in Iraq without seeing some kind of depiction of Saddam, the great Islamic leader, Saddam, the great historical figure, Saddam, the great diplomat, politician, military commander. I mean, there are so many depictions of Saddam that there's almost a book, just a picture book of Saddam in his many hats and guises.
Con Coughlin, thanks very much.
A pleasure to be with you, Neil.
Con Coughlin is the author of Saddam, King of Terror, also executive editor of the Sunday Telegraph, which is published in London. He spoke with us from his home in London.